This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In his 1910 essay on the American boy, Theodore Roosevelt wrote about the value of athletics, specifically football, and the lessons it teaches. He said, in life, as in a football game, the principle to follow is hit the line hard, don't foul, and don't shirk, but hit the line hard. Words to live by for millions of American high school athletes.
Or maybe not. Because those words provoke a question. What is the value of high school sports? Now, before you answer, consider this. Unlike most countries worldwide, the United States spends more tax dollars per high school athlete than it does per high school math student. And we wonder why we lag in international education rankings.
That's how writer Amanda Ripley begins a recent and provocative piece for The Atlantic entitled The Case Against High School Sports. She argues that compared to many other industrialized countries, American schools spend far too much money and time on sports. Resources that could be spent on actual classroom learning, on labs, books, teachers, on time to study and learn. It's a controversial argument, but do you think she might be right? Amanda Ripley is author of the new book, The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way, and she joins us now. And Amanda Ripley, welcome to Radio Boston. Really great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it was a really provocative piece. I've been looking forward to talking to you about it. You surveyed hundreds of former exchange students from around the world, right? And what struck them about the role of sports in American schools?
9 out of 10 international exchange students who had lived in the United States said that American kids cared more about sports than their peers back home. And interestingly, when I surveyed American exchange students as well who had lived abroad, a majority of them agreed that American kids cared more about sports, which is all well and good. And I didn't really, I honestly didn't see a huge problem with it when I set out to visit countries with very high performing education systems and follow kids there. But it was the American kids I was following on in these countries on exchange programs who immediately pointed out to me how strange it was that sports were not part of school in these other countries.
So give us a sense of how much time or how much money, first of all, or resources, any way you measure it, that American schools generally spend on sports or football versus academics. I mean, how did you measure that?
You know, there's been very little research on this. Most districts cannot even give you an all-in figure for how much they spend on sports. They can give you a figure for part of what they spend, but not everything. It's so embedded now in school cultures that we no longer really even think about it or count it as a line item. But there has been some research into this. Marguerite Rosa, who's an economist, looked at this in one public high school in the Pacific Northwest, not a place particularly known for sports, not a big sports high school. And they were spending, once she got actually dug deep and got the all-in number, they were spending $1,348 per cheerleader and $328 per math student at the school. So you typically see a 2 to 4 times rate for how much schools are spending per athlete versus per student.
And so we mentioned those statistics or the comparison about the way Americans in general do on international testing compared to countries like South Korea or even Northern European countries like Finland. What did you find? And sort of relate that to how much attention and time they give to sports.
Well, kids in all these countries play sports. I mean, sports are part of kids' lives, as they should be. But what you typically see is that they play sports outside of school. It's very much secondary. And as kids get older and get into high school, it's even more secondary to academics. So in Finland, for example, which has the highest outcomes in education in the world and the most humane system compared to many countries in Asia, kids do play. I mean, ice hockey is a huge deal, for example, in Finland. And kids do play, but they play on the weekends. They play pickup games. They play on their own. They play through rec leagues, that kind of thing. It's not part of the core mission of school. So this means many things, right? I mean, the most obvious is that schools don't have to pay for it. But I actually think the more impactful implication is that it sends a really strong signal to kids about what school is for. And how you get to be to get attention in school is through academic achievement in these countries. So when you walk into a Finnish high school, you might be able to find some trophies, but If you do, they tend to be dusty and old, and some of them were won by the teachers at the school. It's not a core part of the mission or culture of the school.
You tell such an interesting story in your piece in The Atlantic about the Premont Independent School District in Texas. This is, you describe, as the spiritual home of high school football and the inspiration for Friday Night Lights. But last year, Texas threatens to shut down the school district because of financial mismanagement and academic failure. So tell us what the superintendent did.
So the superintendent had been brought in to save this tiny district, which is about an hour and a half south of Corpus Christi, a majority low-income Latino school district. And one of the things he realized is that he could save $150,000 if he temporarily suspended sports. This, of course, was a terrifying idea. He had spent decades in education in Texas and knew that this would not be popular. But in addition to the savings, he also wanted to send a message to the families, to the teachers, to the kids. He was making other changes at the school, and he wanted to refocus everyone's attention on academics. So it seemed to him that at a school that had already laid off 8 employees, closed the middle school campus, moved its classes into the high school, you know, sealed off the science labs, which were infested with mold, all these things that had happened, to still churn out football, basketball, volleyball, track, tennis, cheerleading, and baseball teams each year maybe confused the message about what was happening in Premont.
Yeah. And so he suspended these sports. It's amazing to imagine that happening, as you say, in the sort of spiritual home of high school football. What were the results of shutting down the sports programs, at least temporarily, at a school?
Well, you know, the student athletes were very upset, as you can imagine, and I don't want to understate that. I mean, they really see this as the highlight of their academic career, and understandably so. That's very different, of course, from kids in other countries, but they have grown up this way. And, you know, the cheerleading captain said to me, you know, we don't get these years back. I'm never going to get the experience of cheering as captain under the lights. And they were very upset about this. Over time, something interesting happened. So I went and visited a year after this decision because I wanted to see, you know, what was it like without Friday Night Lights in Premont, Texas. And a few things happened. More than a dozen students transferred, mostly to a nearby school so that they could play sports. A couple of teachers who were also coaches and very passionate about athletics also left. But the reports from the faculty and the students was that fall, the first without football, was the most peaceful fall that anyone could remember. There was a level of focus and dedication and seriousness that didn't exist before. Now, it's hard to say what caused that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there was new leadership. There were other changes. They had to wear uniforms. The school was really, really in trouble before this. But that first semester, 80% of the students passed their classes compared with 50% the previous fall. And about 160 people attended parent-teacher night compared with 6 the year before. And the last little data point is Nathan, who was the football team's quarterback. An incredible young man who did many different sports. He said to me, you know, at first he was very depressed about this, but eventually he started playing flag football for a club team on the weekends. And he did say, you know, this made you focus. There was just all this extra time and you never got behind on your work. I mean, suddenly he had about 15 extra hours a week that he didn't have before. And he is now attending college nearby in Texas this year.
Listeners, we're talking to Amanda Ripley. She's a writer who wrote for The Atlantic an article called The Case Against High School Sports. What do you think? What do you think about what you hear of this argument? Do sports take up too much time away from the classroom? I'm interested to hear your experience, your high school kids' experience. Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Amanda, let me read you a comment that just came in on Facebook from Kathleen Lambert as she's been listening to you. I went to a jock high school and the message was very clear. This is far more important than academics and is the main point of this institution. Get rid of them all, both college and high school sports, I think she meant to say there. Get rid of them all, both college and high school sports. Is that your conclusion? Do you take it that far?
You know, I think that it's worth having the conversation, asking how much are we spending on this, really, and what is the trade-off that we are making, and do we think that's a good idea, given the higher order skills that we need kids to have to thrive in the modern economy? And your listener makes a good point. I mean, in fact, only 40% of high school seniors in America actually participate in high school athletics. So the research suggests it's pretty great for them overall, that they tend to benefit from sports. And I wouldn't suggest getting rid of sports. I would suggest downsizing it a bit within the school, trying when possible, and this is going to vary depending on the place, to move some of it outside of the school, which actually can be more cost effective. And thinking about those 60% of kids who don't play sports and what message are they sending?
Yeah. And what are they getting out of the deal? What are they getting out of what's being spent on the deal, I guess, right?
Right. And, you know, they're getting something, right? I mean, if they go and are spectators at sports, they're experiencing some sort of, you know, culture and community bonding, and it's fun and all that, you know, team spirit, school spirit. But there's been very little research into what else they're getting. You know, there was one study of 30,000 students at the University of Oregon. This is in college. They found that the grades of men who did not play sports went down as the football team's performance improved. So it may be fun, but, you know, you have to kind of sometimes step back and say, why are we doing this in school?
Amanda, I don't need to tell you that you got all kinds of heated response to your piece. I read one response to your Atlantic piece. Asking Americans to give up football is like asking them to give up their guns. Not going to happen. But there was also a sort of serious rebuttal from Daniel Bowen and Colin Hitt. And they took issue with the way you cite international test score comparisons. And they argue that while overall American test scores are lower than, say, South Korean scores or scores in Finland, some states, like Massachusetts, produce math scores comparable to South Korea and Finland. So they say it's not sports that's lowering the test scores. It's something else. It's a mixture of other factors. So why pick on sports?
Yeah, I don't think sports are the reason. I mean, I think there was a little bit of hyperbole in the headline writing on this story, and I admit that. That was not, unfortunately, at my pay grade. But I do think that, look, sports is a symptom. Yeah. This is a symptom. There is a real fog about what the purpose of education is in the United States, and kids are not everywhere, but very often failing to connect the dots between what they're doing all day in school and how interesting their lives will be until it's too late. So it is true that we have some states that have some very respectable outcomes, including Massachusetts and Minnesota. It is also true that there are now 20 countries with higher high school graduation rates than we have. I mean, this is a situation where we have kind of stood still as a small number of countries have really surged ahead and proven that it is possible to educate virtually all your kids, even your lower income kids, to pretty high levels of critical thinking in math, reading, and science. So I don't think, obviously, you could do away with sports and have no positive impact on a high school. It's about shifting the focus, creating ways to send signals to kids about what actually will serve their interests throughout their lives. And that is interesting to think about. How can we creatively connect the dots for kids?
Well, Amanda, stand by. I want to introduce to the conversation Dan Lebowitz. He's the executive director of the Sport in Society Center at Northeastern University here in Boston. He's been on our show a couple of times. And Dan, thanks for joining us for this conversation. Yeah, you've been listening to Amanda. Just respond. I know that you're a proponent of sports in all its forms. What do you think of her argument?
I think that, you know, there's a lot of things in her argument that make a lot of sense. I would caution that any logic model has to have sort of a cause and effect direct line. And Amanda mentions that she can't exactly say that there is that direct line, although there's an awful lot of data that shows that in the high school that she highlighted that there were grade improvements in a variety of things. I would say that in defense of sport, if you look worldwide, we pretty much have an overarching framework of competition that defines social structures almost everywhere. And I would argue that sport allows for a leadership platform to teach life skills and life lessons in community building, cooperative reliance, collaboration, interdisciplinary thought, leadership skill sets, leadership toolkits, collegiality, positive self-identity, positive collective identity, collective community, and sort of a sense of pride, and also sort of teaches the lessons that we need moving forward into adulthood in terms of long-term health strategies as we are a country that faces an enormity of negative numbers with relation to obesity problems and the onset of diabetes.
Mm. Well, it's so interesting that you brought that up. And first, Amanda, I'd love to just get you to respond to Dan's point. And you actually bring this up in your article that, of course, teamwork, resilience, picking yourself up after defeat, these are all sort of great values that are taught on the sports field. What of those arguments?
Yeah, you know, I played soccer my entire educational career, and I love it. And my son plays soccer. I think you can learn those things on the field. I also think I saw kids all over the world learning those things in school. You know, our kids spend a lot of time in school, and we tend to sometimes underestimate what they can do, particularly in math. Our 15-year-olds rank number one in the world for the percentage who say they get high grades in math, but about 30th in the world for their actual performance in math on average. So, you know, I feel like it would be really exciting if we could think of ways to take that same mindset that we have really mastered in this country around athletics. You know, I see parents be very direct with their kids about athletics, about how they need to work harder and practice and get help and do better. And there's a real kind of honesty there. And that doesn't always transfer to the classroom. If I could very quickly just read, a teacher in Massachusetts actually emailed me after the story came out and said, "It angers me that we seem to believe that sports is the only venue for teaching teamwork, grit, determination, and toughness, as if one could not find those qualities in a youth symphony, a debate team, or a chemistry lab."
Interesting.
Now, this is sort of, you know, those are skills that I saw some very gritty, resilient kids in Finland and Korea. And it may be easier to transfer those skills from, you know, English class to the workplace than it is from football.
We've got a bunch of callers. I want to get them involved in the conversation. But Dan, let me come back to you, because one of the points that I'd like you to respond to that Amanda made earlier is this idea that, let's accept that sports is really valuable, in particular to the people who participate. But there's a relatively small percentage of kids that actually participate in high school sports at a high level. So I'd ask the question, how does it benefit everybody else?
I would say that it benefits the community in terms of sort of that idea of collective community. People rally around their teams. People have a sense of sort of that pride in your school, that's been in many songs throughout our lives. It creates a dynamic where you can rally around something that just isn't the classroom, and it also moves people from isolation. I think that if you just think about individual lesson plans or how each kid is a different type of a life learner, I think sports is part of a much larger equation. I'd have a hard time arguing with Amanda that a lot of the points that she makes are excellent and well thought out and also make a lot of sense. I would also say, though, that, you know, there's a number of kids, I would argue that a number of kids that like fitness want to achieve that fitness through a team approach. I would also say that there's a lot of data out there, including a new book entitled Sparks, that offers research and current data between the direct correlation between physical activity and academic achievement. So I don't think we're in an either-or situation.
No, we're in a really deep and interesting conversation,
right,
though, for sure. I want to give the rest of this segment over to the listeners. We've got a lot of folks standing by. And listeners, if I don't get to you, this conversation is going to continue at radioboston.org. So please go there. You can even go there now and start the conversation or continue it. But let's go to Jay, who's calling from Belmont. Hi, Jay, you're on the air.
Hi, how's it going, guys?
Very well. What's on your mind?
All right, well, I am from the South. I'm from a rather large state in the South, from the center of the state, not far from the town you guys are talking about. And I just wanted to speak to kind of the whole atmosphere that exists down there. Since I was put on hold, you continued your conversation, and I've generated a couple of extra points. And the first one I'll speak to really, really quickly. I'll go down these.
Yeah, Jay, I'm going to ask you to really sort of make one point quickly, because we've got a bunch of callers right
okay,
behind
one
you.
One point quickly then would be, especially where I'm from, they did not press scientific knowledge as a thing that was taught in school or valued. It was not the end result that people went to school to become really good at science or math where I am from. Where I am from, people would tell you, I went to school because I was good at football. And these same people that would teach football to these students were the same people that would teach biology and physics in the same high school. and they did not grasp physics or biology well at all. So you would have this self-reinforcing loop that would tell people the important people are good at sports.
Interesting.
Foolish people concentrate on what's in class.
Jay, I'm glad you put that on the table because actually Amanda brings up this point in her piece that, right, Amanda, that in some cases you've got schools who might be passing over the best science teacher because they found a science teacher that also can coach sports.
It is an unusual American phenomenon, this idea of teachers who really got into teaching because they love to coach. And obviously you could have a great teacher who's also a great coach, but it does complicate things for the school, right? And it was shocking to me when I sat down with principals to hear all the ways that sports infiltrates their daily administrative challenges. They have to think about when they hire teachers if this person can also coach basketball. Many principals spend more time meeting with parents to talk about sports than about academics. I got an email from a principal after the story came out who said, "I've spent more hours on athletics than on curriculum or teacher evaluation this year. I value sports and what they offer to kids. I coached for a number of years, but we're definitely out of balance when a parent tells us that our job is to get their child an athletic scholarship." So, you know, there are signals here, and I think kids really pick up on signals. I think it's easy to underestimate how powerful that is.
Let me go to Matt, who's calling from Rochester, Massachusetts. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. This is a great conversation, and I think it brings up the fact that we have a balance problem in our education. We've been de-emphasizing physical education, I think, and particularly in the lower grades. Something that might take free up budgetary space to expand physical education for everybody, that's going to get everybody involved and get that balance back into everybody's life, is something that could be positive. I think that it would be, again, you know, in the interest of balance, to eliminate sports would have a detrimental effect.
So, Matt, your idea is let's get more people involved with sports, perhaps at a lower level, but getting everyone the sort of positive outcomes of that. Dan Lebowitz, what do you think of Matt's suggestion there?
I think it's an excellent suggestion. I think that, you know, if you look at the current trend in American public schools, there's an enormity of schools that are cutting PE in favor of increasing study time in math, science, English, in an effort to get students pass the tests that have been dictated by the No Child Left Behind. I think that at the same time, you got kids spending about 5.5 hours a day in front of some sort of screen. And so with 30% of U.S. school children overweight and only 6% of U.S. high schools offering a daily physical education class, I think that what Matt is speaking to is an incredibly common sense solution to what could turn out to be very long-term health problems for us. We're not just talking workforce development here in terms of the way we need to have a higher bar, hold a higher academic bar or higher academic opportunity bar or just expect more in the classroom. I think that we have to look at it in a complete vision, and I think that Matt makes a great point.
Well, we're out of time in this segment, but Dan Lebowitz and Amanda Ripley, I want to thank you both. Amanda, thank you in particular for bringing this great, provocative article in front of us and stimulating this conversation. Really grateful. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's Amanda Ripley. She's the author of The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. You can find a link to her Atlantic piece entitled The Case Against High School Sports at RadioBoston.org. And Dan Lebowitz is the executive director of the Sport in Society Center at Northeastern University. Dan, thanks so much to you.
Thanks for having me.
And stay with us. Coming up from Nashville to Boston, Paul Birch is live in our studio. I'm Anthony Brooks with Benga Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.